Accession number 20456, Reel 5.
Brigadier Wilson, Reel 5. You were describing the attack which the Japanese made down the road with medium tanks and infantry following them up.
Yes.
And you said that they didn't stop to deal with your position, they just went straight through it and on towards Singapore.
Well, they hadn't stopped slightly to deal with our position because we were giving them a bit of stick. But basically speaking, the chronology of the attack was at about 7 in the evening, when it was getting dark, our brigade headquarters was about 2 miles up the Bukitima Road, and there was supposed to have been an Australian brigade in front of it, plus an Indian battalion on the flank. And as far as we knew, that was okay. And as I say, about 7 in the evening, our brigadier, Archie Paris, arrived and said to Ian Stewart, "Look, I'm terribly sorry. A Japanese tank has just driven up to my headquarters, fired a few shots over my head at supper, and withdrawn." He said, "I think it'll be back." And so we all said, "Well, you know, where are the rest of the boys?" And he said, "I don't know. My communications have gone." Anyway, the thing was that we had no anti-tank guns, nothing. And so he got hold of his brigade major, Angus MacDonald in my regiment, who had a funny little, tiny little Fiat, which his head almost poked above the windscreen. And he got hold of Angus, and he said, "For God's sake, Angus, drive as fast as you can south towards Singapore. Wake up the first anti-tank gun crew you can see, or anyone else, and tell them that, you know, we are going to be in very severe trouble very soon." So Angus MacDonald set off, and hardly had he set off. And in the meantime, though, I and Harry Nuttall, our armoured car, laid whatever mines we could along the road. We couldn't dig them in. They just had to put them in service. There were six of them. Overturned some farm carts and things we found. We didn't have any wire there. It was a sort of physical block, no more than that. And down the road came the tanks. I'm glad to say one of the mines went off because there was a fairly expensive explosion and, you know, a certain amount of chaos. But this was nothing like a big enough obstacle, so more tanks came down. And what they were doing was firing willy-nilly on either side into the jungle. So it kept your heads down.
Were they firing main armament or...
Both. Michael Black with an anti-tank rifle, and our armoured car held them up for a bit, but eventually, of course, the infantry overran those in the ditches, and they cut the battalion in half. Luckily, I was in the right half. So through they went, and had Angus MacDonald's car not got through, woken up an anti-tank detachment of 18 div that was holding the bottom of Bukitima Hill, those tanks could have walked right into Singapore that night. There was nothing to stop them.
What about their infantry? Were they on foot?
They were on foot. Mm.
So the tanks must have been going rather slowly.
Yes, they were. They were sort of grinding along very slowly. Mm. Yeah.
When the Japanese infantry attacked your entrenchments on either side of the road, how did they actually do these attacks? Did they simply rush them with...
Well, it was sort of hand-to-hand combat in the night. I mean, people were being shot at close range. Mm. One of my chums was sort of standing taking cover behind a tree, and a Jap soldier trodden his toe and said, obviously in Japanese, "I'm sorry." You know?
It was a total
mix-up.
Was there any follow-up to this Japanese?
Oh, yes, there was. Follow-up were the people who wanted to get Bukitima Hill, which was the, I suppose, the most outstanding strategic point in Singapore. who had commanded both the Booking Road and the reservoirs, Pearson McGritchie.
Were you able to hold them up at all?
Oh, yes, 18 did indeed. They had a very severe fight for 3 or 4 days, but the trouble is that they couldn't dislodge them from the hill.
But did they, I mean, in your position, were you able to
no,
hold them up at all?
No, because we were then in the sandwich. We were on the wrong side of the fight. We had Japanese in front of us, as it were, Japanese behind us. Japanese on the side of us, and so the only way was out sideways to the dairy farm, which the road led to, and eventually back to our own camp at Tarsall.
How did you manage to get your chaps out in the dark? Then? It must have been rather complicated.
Well, we just did. We lost an awful lot, we didn't.
Mm. Well, a lot of those lost in the literal sense just got wandered off and cut off. And
that's it. Yeah.
What did you do once you got back to your own camp?
Well, we reorganized ourselves as best we could. This was about 10 in the morning. Various stragglers came in. They were reorganized. Marines came in. What we hadn't realized was that most of our camp had been converted to a temporary hospital, and there were a whole lot of Indian, very badly wounded, lying there with sort of braces and things on their legs and so on. At about 2 in the afternoon, the Japanese came over and bombed it badly, and it all went up, being, attap and bamboo. And so we called for a fire engine, but all the water was off the hydrants. So the best thing we could do was to try and get the wounded out of these burning and sizzling huts into some central place where they could look after, which eventually they were. Eventually, I think they were
saying that you've got the wounded, evacuated them from the Attap huts eventually.
Yes. Well, we then also got what remained of the battalion organised, and we were given orders to march down, I forget which road it was, to relieve a unit in the then front line. And so, having sort of left the wounded in the camp of medicos, we marched out of the camp, and we'd gone about a mile and a half when suddenly a dispatch rider appeared and said, you know, it's all been changed, I'm not wanted, go back. So we marched back to the camp and got ourselves settled in, you know, for the night in our Rowless Reserve. And about 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the evening, I was sent for. A staff guard arrived, and I was told I must get to Fort Canning as quick as I could, leave everything behind, forget the battalion, and report to Fort Canning. Fort Canning was headquarters of my own command. So to Fort Canning I went through the darkened streets and down the various sort of staircases and outside doors and things, and was told, stand by, we are off. So I said, off where? They said, well, we don't quite know, probably Java. So we then got down to the docks, where no one knew about it. So it was Stuart, Angus, myself, son, Meta Bing. There should have been a fifth.
They'd been summoned with you from the camp.
They'd been summoned with them. There were Angus Rose and Bing had been summoned with them. There was pretty good chaos. No one quite knew where we were going to, watch it was going to take us off, we were told just to wait. And in the meantime, I don't know if you know, you've been to Singapore, haven't you? Well, South Singapore Harbour itself are three islands, Lakeng Mati, Sentosa, and Palobrani, all with guns on them. And there are these guns absolutely blattering over our heads, in the big 9.2s and 6 inches. And, you know, it's quite something. Anyway, suddenly out of this murk, a ship bow appeared, and we found that it was a ship we knew very well, HMS Durban, cruiser, and we were told to get on that. And we knew Durban, they were great chums of ours in peacetime. And so this is.
How did you know them? How had you got to know
Well, Durban had been based in Singapore ever since 1939. She was a D-class cruiser, pretty clapped out for those days, but never mind, she was quite something. She was always breaking down. Whenever she broke down, all her sort of ship's company would come and stay with us, and they'd come up with us and train in the jungle. So we knew them very well indeed.
You mean you had sailors trained in jungle warfare?
Oh, yes, certainly. They manned our signal stations, and they did all sorts of things, you see. And on we went, and eventually we sailed out of Singapore with oil tanks on fire all over the place, you know, shroud of smoke. And a very great chum of mine lent me his bunk. And I took on my boots and I went to sleep. And the next thing I knew, I was flat on the floor with an enormous great bang. And what had happened was this: I'd slept till dawn, and the Japanese had sent a formation over to attack us. And one of the anti-aircraft guns smack above my bunk had gone off. And of course, the concussions sent me out. And we were all summoned, all the passengers summoned the wardroom. And more or less given jobs to do. I was a sort of relief stretcher bearer. And told to do nothing until the Navy told us what to do. And so one went there. And the Japanese rarely went for us on the convoy we were escorting. And they were attacking us with formations of 27 medium bombers at a time, who'd all send off one bomb down the chute at a time. You've got a few imaginations of 27 flying in Vs. You've got a dirty great pattern on the sea in which you're in the middle. I say it was most frightening. And we were hit four times. And one had, you know, sort of help get casualties to the war or something. And that went on all that day until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon when they got tired of us.
Have you any idea of how many attacks there were during the course of the day?
Oh, God knows.
There were repeated attacks.
I mean, it was sort of 4 or 5 hours of it. Pretty incessant.
Did the anti-aircraft fire inflict any damage?
Yes, but you see, no, I don't think so, no. All the anti-aircraft fire they had were three, four-inch guns.
Were they attacking at high altitude? Or
high altitude. All the 15, 20,000 feet bombing. And the captain had a sort of, if you can imagine, a reverse bomber sight.
Yes.
And so he could watch them and say, right, they're at release point now, the port on starboard.
Evasive action.
Took evasive action, held us a ship, rather like sort of being on a roller coaster.
How many ships, roughly, were there in the convoy?
I think there were about six. The Empire Star was one, and she was very badly hit. I can't remember the name of the others.
What sort of formation was the convoy in? Was it in...
I don't know.
But was the Durban the only escort?
Yes.
When it was hit, where was it hit? Was it hit?
What?
Where was the Durban hit? What portion?
She was hit. The A and B turrets, 6-inch turrets, were the action. bomb came. German had six-inch guns all down the center line.
Yes.
The director there was out of action. There was an enormous hole where a triple torpedo tube should have been. How if they'd gone up, we'd have been split in half. And sea turret, I think, could just about fight, but no more. I mean, she really was reduced to a jelly, it was Durban.
It does sound as though she was crippled as a fighting vessel.
She was very much crippled. She eventually was sent to Norfolk Navy Yard, Virginia, patched up, sent home, thinking to be reemployed, but no, they took all her guns off her, and she sailed. What do you call those things that the blockhouses, blockships? She is one of the Mulberry outer row of blockships now.
Off Aramont.
That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
But she managed to keep going, presumably. She managed to keep steaming, although she...
What?
She managed to keep steaming, although she'd been hit.
Oh, yes. Oh. No, luckily, the engines and rudder weren't touched. But, I mean, had those three torpedo tubes gone, I don't know where we'd been.
In the water.
We'd have ship been cut in half, you see. Mm.
Did the Japanese continue these air attacks, or was that the...
No, next day they left us alone. Then the next day after that we were in Batavia. Mm. Or Tenjil Prak, I think it's probably...
Did you go ashore at all in Batavia?
Oh, yes. We were decanted. We were decanted ashore. Well, we were supposed to find out what they were going to do with us. And the answer was nothing, because they were destroying our own records. And so, Angus Rees and I, Ian Stewart went up to Bandung for orders, and Angus Rees and I waited, and we were ordered to India. And we got on a naval auxiliary. She was really a straight steamship liner with a couple of guns on her, and made our way up the coast of Sumatra, occasionally being attacked, but never seriously, picking up refugees, and eventually sailed across from Padang to Colombia.
What form did the occasional attacks take? Were they all from the air, or were some from the...
All from the air. Yeah. All from the air.
Did any of them...
No, we were very lucky.
And the refugees, what sort of people were they? Were they...
Well, I mean, they were all sorts of people. They were basically the people from Singapore, the bankers, some of the wives and families, the businessmen, the people who ran the estates, police, all people who would be very useful in intelligence for, you know, the re-attack on Singapore. Yeah.
So you went along the coast. I mean, where were you picking these refugees up? Were they at coastal ports? Or
the what?
Where did you pick the refugees up from? Did you go into the
coastal All these coastal ports are up the way of Sumatra, yes. Padang was the place where most of them would gather.
Yes. And was your ship on its own for that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Completely. No, we were wide open.
Where did you eventually land up when you left?
Ended up in Ceylon.
Where did you go into there? Was it Trincomalee or?
Well, then no, not Trincomalee. What do you call the main port?
Colombo.
Colombo. Yeah. Colombo was like a sort of, how can you put it? The waiting room of a rich man's club. I mean, everyone who knew anyone else was there. You know, for goodness sake, haven't seen you since so-and-so.
It sounds as though it was quite pleasant going to Colombo.
Well, we had about 4 days there before we were all out to India, yeah. To GHQ. What they wanted was anything, because they knew nothing about it, anything of any information of the Japanese than any one of us had.
How did they go about getting the information? Were you given formal debriefings or set to write papers or involved in seminars?
No, we were led to offices and told to write down what happened. I don't remember ever being formally debriefed by anyone.
What happened to the papers you wrote? Do you know?
Oh, I have no idea. In the dustbin, actually. Not the slightest idea.
How long did that process take, then?
About 4 days. Mm. Yeah.
So, were you writing these on an individual basis or a collective basis?
Some were collective, most were individual.
Can you remember what it was that you wrote in your account of...
The difficulty of selecting positions, defensive positions, when the populace, the populace, has disappeared. You know, how on earth do you get war put up? How on earth do you get things dug? Hopeless. And indeed, how did you find out where they got their water from? Well, how many people did it support? There's no good having a defensive position which is waterless. You've got to go outside to get the water.
Do you know what the others put in their papers? Did you discuss?
No. I know Ian Stewart was preparing his final report, some of which comes in that book, but I mean, the actual final report is the goings on in the regiment. Yeah.
So you had 4 days at GHQ. Who were you actually working for at that time? Who gave you your instructions?
I don't know. Some brigadier, brigadiers were quite a young chap, were quite something in those days. I don't know.
What happened after that then?
Then we were ordered to India to report to GHQ India, which meant going up Colombo by train, crossing the ferry, and then a long train journey all the way up from Colombo to New Delhi.
What did they do with you when you got there?
Then we were much more formally dealt with. We were formed into a proper training team. And the idea was first we would go around individually giving our own experiences of what went on. And then secondly, having sort of laid the foundations, we would then join Indian divisions and help them train in the way we had and help them sort of get some idea of what dealing with the Japanese was like.
How did that project run? Did it go well, this idea of going around and giving?
Well, I thought it was all right. I think people who worked with me, well, I can't say that. I don't remember any... It's funny, isn't it? Yes, on again.
You were saying that you were going around the various units.
Yes.
What sort of people were you briefing? What level were you giving them advice on how to deal with the
This was entirely officers. Yeah. Entirely.
But were you going to battalions, or were you going to
brigades. We were being based on brigades.
Yeah. So would you be briefing the brigade staff or all the officers?
No, all the officers in the brigades of the battalions. I did Simla, Abbottabad, Rawalpindi, and then I was transferred to Ranchi and Calcutta. And then that sort of job came to an end. It's a bit odd.
Was all this work you were doing with them purely theoretical, or did you run exercises?
No, it was purely theoretical. One gave them ideas of courses to run, yes.
Yes. I was thinking that perhaps, you know, you might have been able to put over your thoughts by map exercises or things of that sort.
No, we didn't have time.
So it was purely lecturing then.
No, and they didn't have the maps, you see.
Yes.
No, I was personally then transferred to 26th Division, which was in Calcutta, Indian Division. And my, if you can imagine India, you have the Sundarbans, you know, and a very complicated railway system between Delhi, Calcutta, the Sundarbans and Assam.
The Sundarbans being the...
The various Indies, you know.
Distributors of the Ganges.
Yes, now the Ganges. And at that time, or just for that time, the Japanese carrier fleet had come into Indian Ocean and done no end of damage. It had to go to Ceylon, it sank quite a lot of ships, and they were very worried about an attack on Indian mainland. And, of course, Calcutta was a target. What they did not know, or what they didn't have, was the military details of the various railways, particularly the sidings and offloading points, where, because you had them mixed up with river steamers, with the idea of repelling an enemy. And they formed two things. They formed the Sundarban Flotilla, which was a lot of local craft manned by chaps sort of locally commissioned in the Navy. The Indian Railways. And so my job was to try and coordinate the Indian railway network with the Ganges flotilla loading points, so that at least they had some idea of what they could do.
This sounds like a major exercise in logic to get...
Indeed, it was.
...sequences laid out for.
Yeah. I was very surprised. I would have thought that all theirs would have, they'd have had that in peacetime. They did not.
Wouldn't this really have been more a task for someone from the Indian Army Service Corps? A transport specialist?
Well, they were desperately short of people, you see. And what is more, they were desperately short of people who knew the sort of ways the Japanese might operate. In other words, it's business of getting in a place and sort of zipping around the back, as it were. So for something like a month, I spent my time with the Indian, East Indian, not East Indian Railway, East Bengal Railway, sort of putting things on maps that didn't otherwise exist.
I'm very surprised that they didn't have an appreciation of that already. It seems rather strange that no one had done that.
Well, yes, you see, but the hell of your pre-war orientation was Indian Army. Indian Army, North Atlantic. No one had ever really thought about an invasion through Burma, although Burma had come under India.
No one had thought about an invasion through the east coast of India.
No. No, not until that carrier fleet appeared and bombarded the they thought, crikey.
You mentioned a flotilla of river craft.
Yes.
Was this flotilla armed?
Oh, yes. Very, very lightly armed, with things like Bryn guns and anti-tank rifles and two-pounder guns. I mean, it was a makeshift self-coast defence navy, with a bit of intelligence as well.
Do you know where they got the people from to man it?
The what?